The verses that we are looking at tonight are in Ecclesiastes chapter 6. That's where we're going to spend our time, Ecclesiastes chapter 6. And these verses naturally follow what we looked at last week in chapter 5. Solomon is continuing these observations on what we might call, or what he seems to call, the meaninglessness of materialism, our being drawn to the things of this world. Someone has said that what we find here in chapter 6 in these verses is a self-portrait of Solomon, one that he's painted with words, and I'll share with you why in just a moment. Some of this seems to fit his life. But back in chapter 5 and verse 19, right at the end of the chapter, Solomon has told us that the ability for us to enjoy the gifts that God has given us is also a gift of God. He gives us the ability to enjoy what he's given us, what he's blessed us with. And so here in chapter 6, Solomon addresses some of the conundrums, if you will, of life. That's why I'm calling this chapter, or the study tonight, the frustration of life. Because what he looks at in the first six verses is what we might call wealth without enjoyment. And then in verses 7 through 9, labor without satisfaction. And then the last chapter, or the last paragraph, I should say, of chapter 6, verses 10 through 12, there are things that we cannot change, and sometimes we don't seem to understand them. But this first section, wealth without enjoyment. If you look at the first few verses, he begins by saying that there is an evil which I've seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. That statement, that last phrase there, prevalent among men, that the New American Standard translates this group of words, is better translated in another way. And we find it in some of the other translations. The English Standard Version that some of you read from says that it lies heavy. This evil lies heavy on mankind. The New International Version says that it weighs heavily on men. And then there's another translation called the Holman Christian Standard Bible that says that it weighs heavily on humanity. It's something that kind of weighs us down, this problem, this evil that he has seen. Well, what is it? It's an observation he's made. It is a man who has abundantly been blessed by God, because as Solomon says, this man has, God has given him riches, wealth, and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires. God has blessed this man immensely. Now, why did I say earlier that some consider this a self-portrait? Because this describes Solomon. God had richly blessed him. If you go back to 1 Kings chapter 3, there after that prayer that Solomon prays, and God's telling him, ask what he will of him, and Solomon makes his request for wisdom, he comes back in verse 13, that is God does, and says, I have also given you what you've not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. So Solomon himself was blessed with this wealth that he's describing of this individual. But here is the problem. God has blessed this man with all of this wealth and honor, given him everything his soul could desire. But then notice what he tells us about him. He says, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner or a stranger enjoys them. God is giving him all of this. This man has experienced all this, but it's as though, even though he's got all his heart desires, God has not given him the ability to enjoy it. For whatever reason, it's being enjoyed by someone else. Think about this for just a moment. To have all of the resources that you could ask for in life, that you could ever desire, and yet not to be able to enjoy those resources, that wealth, and everything that went with it, it's not just frustrating. Folks, it could be tragic. How many of you, myself included, have known of someone who's worked hard all his or her life, and they've looked forward to a comfortable retirement? They've put money back. They've invested wisely. They have decided we're going to take the rest of our life and we're going to enjoy the days that we have. but then he has a heart attack. And he either dies as a result, or he's incapacitated, cannot enjoy all that he's set aside. Before I came here, 2 years before I came to this congregation, there was a gentleman that was very active. He and his wife had been putting money back, planned to take a vacation to Hawaii. He was going to retire in just a few months. 51 years old. 51 years old. Out rabbit hunting with his brother-in-law on a Saturday morning. Had a massive heart attack in the field and died. His wife, of course, I did the funeral. The words that his wife spoke to me, she said, "Jeff, don't put off you and Becky taking trips when you can. We had planned to spend time traveling. We had been putting money back so that we could travel. And I won't get to do that with him now." This is kind of what Solomon was talking about. The other thing is, maybe there's a crisis in the family. And that crisis not only drains the family finances, but it also drains various members of the family, maybe even the individual who set the money aside physically and emotionally because of what's going on. But for whatever reason, this individual who's put all of these things back, that God has blessed with all of this, suddenly cannot enjoy them. God has not given him or her the opportunity to enjoy the things that they've set aside for themselves. And the question is, why do these things happen? You see, what Solomon has done, if we've read, paid attention to what we've been reading up through this point, is he's given us the answer. And we find that answer in two places. If you go back to chapter 3, there in verse 12 and 13, he says, "I know that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime, or over to every man who eats and drinks, sees good in all his labor." He said, it's the gift of God. That phrase, hold on to that phrase, it is the gift of God. Now chapter 5, verse 19. "Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God." What's Solomon saying? He says, if God blesses you with this, if God gives you these things, allows you to have these things, he also is the one who allows you to enjoy them. It is his gift to you that you are allowed to enjoy that. God is the one who makes it possible for us to enjoy what he's given us. You see, greater possessions do not guarantee greater enjoyment. And the question that comes to our minds, I think a logical question, is why would God allow a person to accumulate, to put back, to have all of this, and yet withhold the enjoyment of those things? Fair question. I'm not going to say this is the answer in all cases, but if you look back to chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, verses 25 and 26, he asked a question, Solomon does. Who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? That is, without God. And then in the first part of verse 26, he says, "For to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy." It is God who gives, and God gives to those who are good in his sight. What does it mean to be good in God's sight? When are you good in God's sight? Have you ever thought about that? When you're trying to follow him, serve him, righteous man shall live by faith. Paul said in several places, Romans 1 verse 17, another one is in Galatians chapter 3 verse 11. But also it's when we realize that it comes from God anyway, that continual gratitude. "In everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus." That's what Paul told the church at Thessalonica. But we have to always remember, if I've been able to have things, if I've been blessed with this, it is because God has given it to me. It's because he's blessed me with it. And I honor him. I serve him. Now, beginning in verse 3, he presents us with an illustration going through verse 6. And it works like this. He says, if a man fathers 100 children, now read on, and lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, as the New American Standard translates it, then I say, better the miscarriage than he, for it, that is the miscarriage, comes in futility and goes into obscurity. Its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun. It never knows anything. It is better off than he, even if the man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things. Do not all go to one place. Solomon uses exaggeration to make a point. The exaggeration is, here is a man who has great progeny, 100 children. Now, I don't think these were all through the same wife. I hope they're not all through the same wife. But Gideon had 70 sons. When you go back to the book of Judges, now that was through many wives. Rehoboam, who was Solomon's son, had 88 children through 18 wives and 60 concubines. But those are the highest numbers that we find in Scripture that I'm aware of. You may know of some that are more than that. But this man not only has 100 children, he also, as Solomon lays it out, he enjoys a long life. The man lives 1,000 years. If you look at the end of it, 1,000 years twice. 2,000 years he has the opportunity to live. No one in Scripture is listed as, I mean, that outdoes Methuselah by more than twice, you know, 969 years old. So this individual has a lot of children, big family, lives a very long life, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial. The man has abundant resources. He has a large family, which in Solomon's time were marks of God's favor upon an individual. That's the way it was viewed. But his family doesn't love him, apparently, because when he dies, they don't mourn his passing. He doesn't even have a proper burial. It's more, when's the old man going to die so we can get some of the inheritance? When's he going to finally kick the bucket so we can have some of what he's been putting back? You see, that's the idea here. And Solomon's point is this: no matter how much you possess, if you don't possess the power to enjoy it, he says you might as well never have been born. And at least as he talks about the stillborn child, the miscarriage, is better off than he is. Why? It is because that child that never saw the light of day, that child that was never born into this world, at least alive, was spared the toil and the anxiety and the misery of the soul of this man that was never satisfied. He never had to experience all of these things and not enjoy them. He had it better off. And then he adds something else. He says that the wealthy man and the stillborn both go to the same place. They both go to death. They both die. They both go to the grave. So his question is, when we look at this, it is the idea of wealth without the ability to enjoy the wealth. And the point he is making is, if you have the ability to enjoy the wealth, thank God, because God is the one that gives you that ability to enjoy what he's allowed you to have. First thing. Second thing, verses 7 through 9, labor without satisfaction. And what he says is that all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have, knowing how to walk before the living? What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and striving after wind. What Solomon does is he turns us from the rich man with his wealth and his inability to enjoy that wealth to the poor man and just what we might call the general insatiability of the human life, the idea of just not being satisfied. And what he says to us here is, all a man's labor is for his mouth. All a man's labor, Solomon says, is for his mouth. It serves to satisfy a person's appetite. we might also add in with that, to find pleasure and contentment. And yet, in spite of this, what does he say? The appetite, and literally there, it is the soul, is not satisfied. Why is the soul not satisfied? Go back to what we looked at last week. God has set eternity in our hearts. There's more to life than just the satisfaction of the physical desires. You know, why do you and I eat? I enjoy food as much as the next guy, but why do we eat? Is it not to sustain our lives? What happens if you just stop eating and don't ever eat again? You're going to die. We eat in order to add years to our lives. We work in order to provide the things that we can have what we need in order to be able to eat and to provide for ourselves and take care of our lives. So here's the question. What good is it, Solomon is asking, to add years to your lives but not to add life to your years? You understand what I'm saying? You add years to your life, you live a good long life, but there's no life in those years. If all a person does is live to satisfy his or her appetite, the desire to be satisfied, then the point that he's making is that the wise man has no advantage over the fool. And nor does the poor man have any advantage in trying to better his situation. That is, and learning to get along with the rich. In these verses, Solomon's not belittling education. And folks, he's not belittling self-improvement. What he is telling us, though, is that these things in and of themselves cannot make a person's life richer. No. You see, we've got to have something greater for which we're living. We've got to have something that really gives life true value and purpose. And Solomon's statement, notice verse 9, what the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. You and I have heard a familiar phrase that, or a statement that fits right along with that. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. In other words, what you have your hands on is what you better than what you're hoping to get over here. You're hoping to grab. It's better to have a little and really enjoy the little that you have than to dream about much and yet never attain that. Now, Solomon is not telling us not to dream big dreams. He's not telling us not to have ambition and to strive for something, to try to accomplish something in life. But what he does want us to make sure that we do is to be sure that our ambition is motivated by the glory of God. That what we're doing to his glory and not simply for the praise of men or the recognition of men. Do you remember what Jesus said on one occasion to his disciples there at the well in Sychar? The woman had, the disciples, if you remember, had gone into the village to get food. Jesus stayed out by the well. The woman came to draw water, and he talks to her about living water. And then when she realizes he's the Messiah, she goes back into the village to tell others about him. And the disciples are coming back about that time, and they brought food for him. And he tells them he's got food that they don't know about. And they wonder, did somebody bring him some food? And he said, my food is to do the will of my Father who sent me and to accomplish his work. You see, this is similar to what Solomon is saying. And that is that life lived well is a life that focuses upon doing God's will, honoring him. And so this is why, as he would say, labor does not satisfy. We can work and work and work and put back and put back and put back. But if we're not living a life that is life indeed, we're really not gaining. The last thing, if we pick up in verse 10 and come to the end, there are things that we cannot change, and Solomon wants us to understand that. We may not understand them, but he wants us to know you can't necessarily change them. And I won't just not go through the whole text, But I want to pick up one of the first things that he tells us that we cannot change is what God has established. There in the beginning of verse 10, notice what he says. He says, whatever exists has already been named, and it is known what man is. What does he mean by that? I think he means that God has established the nature and essence of everything that exists, including us. And he did that long ago. Let me give you some examples. God said in the beginning, let there be light. And there was light. It's light. It's always been light. It will always be light. It's not darkness. It's different from darkness. Because we're told there that there was light and there was darkness. So God has named certain things, light, darkness. We understand this is light. When we turn these lights out, we understand it's darkness. We have dark in here. Not only that, we also understand, and there was day and there was night. You wouldn't go outside and say, oh, it's day out here. No, we understand. The day is when the sun is up or when the sun is shining. The night is when the moon is out. We understand that because God established that all the way back in the beginning. And folks, to my knowledge, it's never changed, has it? These are things that God has set in place. Think about something else. These are names which God has given. God breathed into man the breath of life, and he became a living soul. What do we still, even in this woke society, what do we still typically call a male individual, a man? Do you know who gave that name? God. Adam means from the earth. God did that. That's not something we did. God gave that long ago, and it does not change. As a matter of fact, if you go back and look in here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 15, there's a statement that Solomon began by making. He said, what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. There are certain things that God has set in place, and you're not going to change that no matter how much you want to change it. Or if you go to chapter 3, verse 14, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it. There is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. There are things that God has put in place that there is no changing because God has established it, and this is the way it will always be until God changes that. And no amount of trying to make it change is going to change it. It's always going to be the way God has established it. But if you continue to read on there, the next thing that he says, picking up with the latter part of verse 10 and going into verse 11, he says that he, man, cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he. Well, who's the one that's stronger than man? It's God. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? The point is, it's useless to try to argue with God about what he has ordained. I don't like it, God, that you did it that way. Well, I'm sorry, but that's the way I did it, and that's the way it's going to be. But you ought to change it. No, that's the way I made it. That's the way it's going to be. But I don't agree with it. You can disagree with it, but this is the way it's going to be. It is useless for you to try, or me, to try to argue with God. Because, as Solomon says here, God is too strong. You're not going to overcome God. You're not going to make God change something that he has set in place. And the point that Solomon makes here is that the more we argue with God, the less we accomplish. I take you, we're not there that yet, but in chapter 10, verses 12 through 14, Solomon said that words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious, while the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of his talking is folly, and the end of it is wicked madness. But notice this next part. Yet the fool multiplies words. Have you ever had a child, or maybe somebody that you knew that thought if they could just talk to you long enough, they'd wear you down to where you'd finally give in and change your mind and give them what they wanted? We've all probably, if we haven't encountered it personally, maybe we know someone who has. The fool multiplies words. If we try to do that with God, it does not work. And Solomon is saying, you need to accept what God has created. You need to work within the system He has established and learn how to follow Him. Which brings us to the next little point found in verse 12. For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He will spend them like a shadow. Let me ask you, who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime? Not a trick question. God. God knows what is good for you during your lifetime. He actually knows what's better for you than you know for yourself. God knows far more about us than we know about ourselves because He created us. Just like the manufacturer of something, the person who designed it and maybe put it together knows more about an object, a piece of machinery, than somebody else that did not have that process, did not have the hands-on experience. And so because of that, God knows what is best for us, and we are wise if we take the time to listen to God. Over in Proverbs chapter 9, verse 10, Solomon said something. He said that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. If you really want to know how to live your life, Solomon would say, you need to listen to the one who gave you life, the one who breathed in the man the breath of life, the one who created all of this that we see around us, because God knows more about what causes us to do well in life than we will ever know for ourselves. And even though Scripture teaches us on several occasions that our lives are fleeting, you know, James says they're the vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away, even though that is true, the Apostle John reminds us that those of us who do the will of God live or abide forever, over in 1 John chapter 2, verse 17. The last part of this chapter, very end of chapter, or verse 12, he asked another question. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? In other words, God knows what's coming next. You and I don't know what's coming next. We know what God has told us, but we don't know what tomorrow or the next day or the next day holds, do we? We really don't know if the sun's going to shine tomorrow. The weathermen do the best to predict it, and I've heard several of you talk about it. I've never seen anybody can be wrong so many times and still have a job. And if we're sports aficionados, never seen a quarterback that could miss so many passes and still stay on the team. Never seen a baseball player that could strike out so many times and still be playing in the MLB. You know? God knows what tomorrow holds, as we sometimes sing, I know who holds tomorrow. He is the one that knows the future. It's futile for us to speculate about what the future holds. And God gives us just enough information to encourage us. If He told us everything that was going to happen, I think it would overwhelm us. But God is big enough to handle it and know it. I'm glad I don't know all of the details that God knows and keeps up with on a regular basis. But there's one thing for sure. One thing that I think all of us do know, and God's told us this, death is coming. I don't know when. I just know it's coming. And I know that He's going to return. And there will be a judgment. And as Jesus Himself said, He will separate because He's the one who will do it. The sheep, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goat, the righteous on the right hand, the others on the left. There will be some, He will say, enter into the joy of your Lord. There will be others, He will say, I don't know you. Those things we do know. And the ability for you and I to enjoy our lives, no matter how long or short those lives may be, folks, that's a gift from God. It's what Solomon's been trying to tell us. It's God's gift to you. Use it, enjoy it, serve Him with it. But He longs to give us, as we saw back in chapter 2, wisdom and understanding or knowledge and joy. because of the time that is coming. Because he's fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man that he's appointed. And he's furnished proof of that, as Paul said there in on Mars Hill, by raising that individual from the dead. We know who that is. It's Jesus Christ. But the question for each one of us is, where are you right now in your life? Are you enjoying the life that God has given you? Are you cherishing each moment? Are you thanking him for the days he's giving you and trying to use those days wisely in his service? If you're doing that as a Christian, you are a blessed individual, and may God continue to watch over you. But if you're here tonight and you're not a child of God and you're not living that life, please, please don't continue in that vein. Make a difference in your life. Choose tonight, not tomorrow, not next week. Choose tonight, right now, to give your life in obedient faith to him, to confess him as Lord and Savior, to turn from your sin, to be buried with him in baptism so he can wash away those sins and allow you to start a whole new life. If that's something you need to do tonight, we invite you to come as together we stand and sing.